You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 124.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to The Local Maximum, another episode of The Local Maximum. Joining me, as usual, Aaron. How you doing today?
A little tired, but doing well.
Hopefully got a lot of sunlight. It is the lightest day of the year.
I did. We went out, and after much demanding from my children, we ran under the sprinkler. So
that's
it is
great.
Officially summer now.
I've had a great time outdoors. The only thing that has been on my mind, and I know this shouldn't be a big deal. This shouldn't be on my mind. I should just forget about it. But like last week, I somehow misplaced my sunglasses or left them somewhere, and I have backup, so it's not really that big of a deal, but it's like, it's bothering me a lot. I've had them for so many years, and it's like, where could I have put them? No idea.
I traced, feel for you, yeah.
Yeah, I traced them, and I'm like, I know my cousin was in the car. He's like, I think you had them, you were wearing them when you were in the car, and I'm like, it could just be my glasses, which automatically darken. So I don't really know. I purposefully didn't bring it out of the car, but now it's not in the car. I don't know. It could be anything that's going
on.
Well,
don't let it get under your skin. Inevitably you will find them as soon as you have ordered a replacement pair, or you won't, and it won't matter because you've ordered a replacement pair.
Right, right. All right. So today we've got a big topic, a controversial topic. Historically, social networks have positioned themselves as neutral platforms where people can share whatever they want to friends and followers. Twitter once called itself the free speech wing of the free speech party. Well, it looks like that party is about to end, for better or worse. So I'll tell you why today, and we'll talk about it. First, we have two sponsors today, Aaron. Isn't that great? This episode is sponsored by ActiveState. They do continuous integration and continuous deployment for all your engineers out there. If you work as a software engineer, you might be interested in continuous integration tools to help yourself and to help your company. ActiveState has been making open source easier for developers to use and simpler for enterprises to adopt for more than 20 years. They are currently looking to improve the state of the world with continuous integration and continuous deployment. So take their survey. You can link it at, it's linked off of localmaxradio.com/124. Also, this episode is sponsored by Rion, R-I-O-N, Raw Internet Object Notation. You might not think you're in the market for data formats, but you are, and especially as a data scientist. And Rion by NanoSci is a new data format. Later in the show, we'll talk about why you might want to check it out. All right, so why are social networks starting to explicitly fact check? And is this kind of a one-time thing for the crazy world of 2020? Is it because all the misinformation about the pandemic or Trump or all that, or is this permanent? Personally, I think this is permanent. I think there's a ratchet effect every time they fact check, that they want to get involved with what people are saying. And as they do it more and more, they don't ever step back and say, oh, we don't have to do this anymore. That's never going to happen. They kind of actually like doing it. And it's not just that they like doing it. It's like they have a lot of pressure, people who are kind of cheering them on and pressuring them to do it more. So first I'll read just three questions that I asked, three thought questions to just kind of say, how do we think about fact-checking? How do we think about what these companies are doing? And then we'll check out some of the articles. The three questions that I want people to think about, and if you have answers to these questions of your own, you could email localmaxradio@gmail.com. The first one I have is the one that I just asked, is the unfact-checked big social network a thing of the past? Was this kind of a crazy idea that was never going to work to begin with, and is it actually coming to an end? I could see various positions on that. Two, is it possible to make fact-checking fair? Like, what is the goal? I think if there's an umpire or referee, nobody says, refereeing a basketball game, well, that's just impossible. Nobody says that. So is this actually possible? And three, even if it is possible, is it the goal for these fact checkers to be fair, or do they have some other agenda? Are they necessarily going to have some other agenda? So those are the three questions that I have. Let me dive into the New York Times article. I think this is from last month. This is from May 26th, 2020. And this is basically when Twitter started fact-checking. They fact-checked Trump's tweet. Now, you might say, what? To me, like this, I don't know, maybe it's a little bit of a crazy tweet. I don't think it's like the craziest that I've ever seen from him. I don't know what that says, but... so this is
of all the tweets to pick to start with fact checking, this one doesn't stand out as the most egregious.
Right. Okay. But anyway, so here's his tweet. So Twitter. So New York Times wrote about this. Here's the actual tweet. I'll read it. He writes, "There is no way zero exclamation point. The zero is in brackets and parentheses. There is no way zero that mail-in ballots will be anything less than substantially fraudulent. Mailboxes will be robbed. Ballots will be forged and even illegally printed out and fraudulently signed. The governor of California is sending ballots to millions of people." So Twitter has big, bold letters at the bottom. Get the facts about mail-in ballots. And then they link to a CNN headline that says Trump makes unsubstantiated claim that mail-in ballots will lead to voter fraud. So, again, it's interesting to start with this one. I think... So they say it's unsubstantiated. There's a big difference to me between false and unsubstantiated. It's like, well, we have mail-in ballots. Like, I've seen mail-in ballots before. We have mail-in ballots for, you know, for people who vote from home, you know. But there is kind of a, not logical, but there's, you know, it's not crazy to say, well, this is going to be very different if everybody's mailing in versus just the people who are doing absentee ballots, where it's, you know, you can't like go look through mailboxes if you don't know who is voting absentee, which you usually have to apply for. So that would only be a good strategy if you are if everybody is voting by mail, but or if a large, you know, if a large, I don't know if the proposal is actually for everyone to vote by mail or just to have it be kind of the standard. But anyway, yes, we don't know if Trump's prediction actually is going to come true. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. It probably won't. But it's also like it's a prediction about what will happen, and that sounds like something that should be like argued out. Like, what's the, you know, what are the reasons it'll happen versus the reasons that'll not happen, and not like, you know, not fact-checked in this way. You know, so he says unsubstantiated claim that mail-in ballots will lead to voter fraud. Well, okay, ask him to substantiate it, and like, why won't it? Like, it is it totally impossible that it could lead to voter fraud? Is that like totally, you know, 100% impossible on the face of it? That to me sounds like a hard claim to make.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a prediction. If he had said that every time in the past where mail-in ballots have been used, they've been plagued with fraud, that's something that you could probably fact-check a little bit more vigorously.
But
this is not a deviation from what we've come to expect from statements from President Trump. That. While he may not be telling an outright falsehood, he is not encumbered by the facts here.
But we don't really know what the he's pointing out something, right, that we don't really know what the story is with fraud in our elections. Every article I've read seems to like hand wave away a lot of potential problems. And so I think the integrity of our voting system is complex enough that this clearly isn't a statement like the sky is green. And it's definitely something that should be debated.
Yeah, I think this encounters many of the same problems that we have in discussions of the illegal immigrant or undocumented immigrant problem. That by the nature of the problem, it is difficult to put a number on exactly how many they are, because they
sure,
are
yeah.
not clearly documented. And so, you know, both sides of the argument are going to come at it and say, well, we believe that there are X million. And the other side's going to say, well, no, there really aren't. It's a fraction of that. It's, you know, only X million have been confirmed. And the counter argument would be that, you know, on the one side, these are the numbers that we can statistically prove given the data that's been collected, and the other side will say, yeah, that's our point. There's not data on enough of this that we can't statistically put an upper bound on it. So
So this is where you have to have a open discussion and not a, this is an open and shut, I'm going to tell you what's right and what's not.
Yeah, and it forces you to get beyond the simple soundbite because, you know, we may be able to agree on the results of some study that found that there are X million number of undocumented immigrants, but what are the, you know, what's the uncertainty? What did they actually measure? Because it's probably a proxy for something else. And you need to have a much more complex discussion to understand the nuances of that rather than just saying, this is the number, it's right or it's wrong.
Right. People often want to know, this is the number, this is what's right, the New York Times told me so, and everybody else is full of it.
Yeah, most people don't have the patience, even if they have the statistical acumen, to dig down on everything to that level.
All right. So here is a quote from the New York Times on the pressure being put on Twitter, which I think is a big story. It's hard to underestimate how much pressure these companies are being put under. They say, Mr. Trump's high level of activity has brought attention and growth to Twitter. If the company deleted his tweets or altered them, it would escalate accusations from conservative politicians that it censors their political views or was biased against them. But by doing nothing, Twitter was also being misguided, said Joan Donovan, research director at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center. I don't know if the whole person is relevant who studies disinformation. Oh, it's interesting. People study disinformation. Well, that's so weird to have a study of disinformation. We could have a whole discussion about that. But anyway, to continue this quote, if I comment on the quote as I read the quote, I'm sorry. Okay, to continue the quote, if world leaders are not kept to the same standard as everyone else, they wield more power to harass, defame, and silence others. So, so she's not saying, that's kind of confusing because he's not being held by the same standard as everyone else. If I tweeted that same thing, nothing would have happened. Or if Lady Gaga or Katy Perry, who has the highest Twitter followers, tweeted that, I don't think that would have happened either. Or Justin Bieber or any of these people.
Yeah, I think to say that they must be kept to the same standard as everyone else is a little disingenuous because this reads much more as a line about everybody's favorite neighborhood Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. And so because of his greater reach and the reputation is perhaps the wrong word, but
yeah,
associated with the office of the president, they are holding his tweets to a higher standard.
Right. So it says, like, you know, they're kind of worried about Trump. He has the power to harass, defame, and silence others. But to me, it's like the president hasn't had the power to silence anybody. If he had, we would see a very different discussion.
Yeah,
it's
harass Twitter and defame, Facebook, I think, are very different than silence in this context.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you consider that shouting them down is silencing them. But I take issue with that.
Yeah. And even, well, the people getting harassed and defamed are not people getting harassed by the president. Well, you could probably point to something, but it's very mild compared to what's happening from the other side is what I see. It's unambiguous right now. I mean, look, it could flip at some point in the future, but that's not the way it is right now. Well, all right.
I mean, has Joe Biden's campaign tried to file a complaint with Twitter that they're being bullied with all this sleepy Joe Biden name calling that maybe will get him kicked off of Twitter.
Yeah, maybe. All right. So this is why it's the end of the non-editorial stance from Twitter. They can't keep this up anymore. The amount of pressure is mounting and leadership of these companies are not in the mood to stand firm. They'll do anything to appease.
I think they would stipulate that they are being non-editorial in that they are just fact checking. But that is a very, very thin curtain to hide behind here.
I've tried to be neutral on these things in the past, but I just don't buy it anymore. It's so disingenuous. I've seen too much. Let's talk about active state, and then we could get back to this discussion. How about that? All right. I just want to remind you that if you are in software engineering, you still have to get your work done. and you could still bring immense value to your company. And so, especially as we get back to work, if you work in software, it just keeps going, and that's what continuous integration is. It's your in continuous deployment. You're deploying code, you're shipping code all the time. So if you're like me, you're consistently thwarted and mystified by your build tools and continuous integration tools at work as a software engineer, architect, and there are some of you out there who are really great at this stuff. I love you guys, even if you're one of the crazy coworkers who I complain about sometimes, who I might complain about later, but I need people who do deployment and integration at my company, because it would slow us down completely if we didn't have that. So I just want to tell you about ActiveState. ActiveState has been making open source easier for developers to use and simpler for enterprises to adopt for more than 20 years. ActiveState helps enterprises scale securely with open source languages and gives developers the kind of tools they love to use. More than 2 million developers, 97% of Fortune 1000 enterprises use ActiveState to support mission-critical systems and speed up software development while enhancing oversight and increasing quality. They're inviting us all to do a survey which I've done, by the way. It's not too hard. I did have to look up a little bit about what Foursquare does, but it's not too hard. And they're trying to understand the state of integration and deployment tools at your company, at my company, at various companies. So definitely check out that localmaxradio.com/124 and check out their products as well. Maybe your company is due for a change in this department, or maybe you work for a startup and you're trying to set up continuous integration right now. So if you want to learn more about these tools, localmaxradio.com/124. It's something every software shop needs today. All right. So three questions that I'm thinking about when it comes to fact checking. You ready to go, Aaron?
Let's do it.
All right. So first, is the fact-checked big social network a thing of the past? Was this an unsustainable idea to begin with? I say I am now firmly in the belief that this can't go on. They'll never go back to being the unfact-checked, unbiased. And if another unbiased one tries to crop up, they will immediately get crushed. If in order to get around this, we're going to have to do something very creative. I think we will ultimately, but it's going to take time.
And I suppose if we've hit that point, then it's a moot question to ask, was this a sustainable idea to begin with? Since we've crossed the Rubicon there, it's too late to go back.
I want people to know that internal activism at tech companies by employees, it's getting to an unbelievable, for people who don't know, like, they're using all the Q&A sessions, all of the all hands to demand from their employers, their executive teams, that they need to do more to support the cause. And there's never any pushback against any of these questions.
Yeah, I'm in a slightly different position since the mothership for my company is based in Europe and we have a rather small operation in the U.S. So the dynamic is a little bit different there.
Yeah, no, I mean,
That combined with the fact that prior to my current role, I've mostly worked in the defense sector. And while that does not completely change the equation there, I'd say there's a disproportionately high percentage of conservative leaning folks in that business space than average for a high tech industry.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, I would be embarrassed. I don't consider myself a conservative, but if conservatives were demanding this stuff from employees, from like their employers at Q&A, like I would be just as like embarrassed for what's going on. Like, I just don't want the workplace to be so politicized. You wouldn't believe some of the things that I've seen. And
there used to be the expectation that you could separate politics from friendship, and that certainly you could separate politics from work. And that is rapidly eroding if it has not completely done so already.
Right, right. And I have other examples as well.
Prior to the current management, the head of my office when I first hired on, who is no longer with the company, but he was very much right of center, and he was not uncomfortable about sharing those opinions in the workplace, which certainly made me cringe a little bit. So it's maybe the other side of your opinion. And I don't think he was using it to drive company policy by any means, but we would go to the cafeteria at work and political topics would come up, and
Oh, the cafeteria, forget it. I just get up and go.
there were definitely times when I wished that we hadn't opened the door to this topic.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so right. So there's an article from recently, or the beginning of the month, Facebook employees stage virtual walkout to protest Trump's posts. So if Facebook is evil because they censor people, employees are like, not evil enough, not evil enough. That's what I feel like. That's the world I think we live in now. But no, and Trump is like a great foil because like people have such emotional reactions to Trump that you could be like, okay, you know, anything we could do against Trump is good, even though you're not, but then you're not thinking through the implications of what you're saying, which is give this company a virtual monopoly of sorts, you know, the ability to say who can and can't speak.
Yeah, there's a serious discussion to be had about means versus ends, and I'm not claiming to have always been a purist on this, but it's very easy when you're very passionate about a topic to say, to hell with the means. I'm all about the ends, and I'm willing to sacrifice certain things to get there. And it's very difficult to walk back from that once you've done.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, so, look,
I think a lot of us have had a revelation about things similar to that in the wake of 9/11 and in the second Iraq war, that we may have thought that it was worth it at the time because of our emotional reactions and the things that we believed at the moment, and we realize now that we did some things that we're not proud of and that we really shouldn't have let ourselves get to, and I think we're seeing something similar in the tech sector now with these platforms that people are very willing to sacrifice freedoms and rights in order to pursue what they feel is a higher goal.
Yeah, means and ends are, man, ends justify the means is like the oldest trick in the book. And I just think, you know, it's simple. It's people, you know what's right and wrong, and you can analyze it. But people have just been, I feel like, you know, the whole... What's the whole thing with the kid? Like if so-and-so walked off a cliff, would you too?
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel these days everybody is walking off a cliff and nobody remembers that.
Well, and it's an escalation problem or a tragedy of the commons that if you are competing with somebody who has decided to abandon the means and they are only concerned with the ends, that it's hard to stand up against them without getting down into the mud and playing dirty. There's an inherent advantage to not playing by the rules, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, so look, I don't see how anyone could argue with a straight face, oh, this is just to stop Trump. This won't go beyond Trump. Once Trump is out of power, Facebook and whatever will stop doing this, and it'll be all free and open again. I can't see anyone arguing that with a straight face.
Everybody's talking in the context of the coronavirus about, there's going to be a new normal, or some people saying, when we get back to normal. And I think this is an area where there will be a new normal that you mentioned earlier, a ratchet effect. This, you may be able to walk back a little bit from this, but we're not going back to an era before this was a thing.
Any heterodox opinion, any opinion outside the mainstream will be suspect. And those are the types of opinions. Sometimes they're crazy, but that's where progress comes from.
Yeah, barring a major reset, which will not be clean and painless.
No, I think it'll be the downfall of these companies ultimately, but it might take a really long time.
The question is, will it take the nation with it?
Yeah. Well, here's an article from The Guardian from April that I thought was interesting. So this is before the stuff with Trump. I mean, there's other stuff with Trump going on. But, they were using something from, so this is The Guardian from the UK, right? And so now I don't even know if they describe someone as like crazy, anti-Semitic or whatever, if that's even true. But let's just take that at face value. They're talking about someone who was, spreading the meme that these 5G towers are causing coronavirus. And he thinks that the, quote, Zionists are involved. I'm pretty sure. Look, that's a case where I'm pretty sure he's talking about Jews there. But look, and they're like, oh, my God, if he keeps on like spreading this disinformation, people are going to go out there and they're going to destroy these 5G towers, which is which seems to be the worst thing in the world. So yes, at least in this point, the target is even more clear. Like, yeah, that guy is batshit, no question about it. Assuming that the Guardian was accurate enough about what he's saying, but it sounds like they can't be that far off, I don't think. So, but the problem with the Guardian article is like, yeah, they might have started to stop this guy who's batshit, but they haven't. You know, they haven't done enough. They need to stop everybody who is saying anything remotely in the ballpark, and they need to do more. They need to do more. Any piece of information, and I could see where this is leading. It's like any piece of information that interacts with that conflicts with my worldview must be stomped out. And it starts with someone who's obviously completely insane, but then it moves further and further until it starts to eat itself, right? And they like the fact that this is working. Like, they got rid of Milo Yiannopoulos. That guy, I found him so annoying. I found some of the things he said so over the top. But yeah, and some of the stuff he did to other people on Twitter was not right. But they got rid of him on Twitter. It worked. So they're like, yeah, it worked. Let's keep on rolling down the field. Keep on, you know, they love this power. And they're just going to keep on pushing forward until the end of time. As long as they're not stopped, they're going to keep pushing for more. And that really concerns me now, because these crazy people, nobody was going to... A large percentage of the population was never going to buy their stuff to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, there,
that's how I feel. I'm just giving you my feeling here.
There's a popular quotation that I don't have it word for word, but it's something to the effect of that free speech is not required for popular opinions. What they're doing is running out the. You know, non-orthodox opinions or non-approved ones, and that's precisely what the concept of free speech is supposed to protect. Where you get into gray areas is where it goes beyond simply speech, and it's, you know, incitement to violence or fighting words or other things that maybe have a more complex legal angle to them, and that's not necessarily an easy thing to determine, but it's very tempting. From a liability and to satisfy their whether the voices are internal or external that are the loudest, to cut a little bit closer to the bone there and make sure that they've trimmed away everything that could possibly be problematic, instead of trying to walk the very fine line on the edge of what's free speech and what's actually, you know, criminal wrongdoing.
Right. No, yeah, that. Along the edges thing is not what's happening here. But what you said about free speech, I mean, look, I've read a fair amount of political philosophy. There are some political philosophers who are totally against free speech, but the ones that are, you know, foundational to like, you know, our freedom of thought and the freedoms that we enjoy in the United States and some other places around the world, they've all said the same thing. Anyone from and from different parts of the political spectrum, anyone from like both Jefferson and Hamilton all the way like to Martin Luther King, they all said this. They were all free speech maximalists. And basically now people just want to turn their back on all of that. I feel like a statue of Teddy Roosevelt or Martin Luther King will come down before a statue of Lenin these days. All these statues are coming down. I've never heard of a statue of Vladimir Lenin coming down, and there's one here in New York, you know. So what? If you can't see what's going on, I don't understand. I'd like to talk to you, because if you could tell me that something different is going on here. It seems like the world's gone crazy, Aaron.
Yeah. Well, and it's. You have to take into consideration the opinions of far right wing groups like the ACLU, who take a stance to protect outrageous and offensive speech. In fact, reaching back into the mists of time as far back as 2010, you may remember the Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church.
Oh yeah, they protested us at Foursquare once. I wasn't there. They did like a march around New York, and basically I was like, what do they have against us? We're just a startup. And
they
were protesting us for trying to turn a profit, which we haven't done in 10 years. But maybe they'll like us now.
So back in 2010, the ACLU actually filed a friend of the court brief supporting the Westboro Baptist Church, and with this little tidbit in there. To be clear, the ACLU strongly disagrees with the protesters' message in this case, but even truly offensive speech is protected by the First Amendment. And they go on in more detail. But I think that gets the core of the message across. Then the question is, have we abandoned that? Have we shifted our Overton window? Or are we just being drowned out by other voices in this discussion here?
I think people have been taught differently these days that, you know, free speech is not a very high value, and I fear we'll pay the price, you know.
And I guess 2010 was either before or in the early, very early days of considering your privilege and microaggressions and many of the things that have become de rigueur.
I got that in Yale. I actually got that at a summer camp in 1998.
Oh wow!
That's been going on for a long time, but it's been bubbling up, you know, to the mainstream for a long time. But when I saw it at summer camp, when I saw it at Yale, I was just like, oh, these are just, you know, these are just insane people that I don't have to deal with. And now it's different. But yeah, no, I really don't get it. Like, there are people out there that hate me, that not hate me personally, but like, you know, maybe hate that a group that I'm in, whether it's Westboro Baptist Church hating Foursquare, or whether it's, you know, there's a lot of anti-Semitic stuff online. I've never had a problem with freedom of speech. I don't know why all of a sudden people are taught to have that problem. That's the way it is these days, I guess. And by the way, freedom of speech, I'm talking about the broader freedom of speech, not just the First Amendment, but these, you know, I know people can say, oh, these are private companies. But no, they are where our discussions are taking place. It doesn't mean that you have a First Amendment right to say anything on those. Obviously, it's not a political right, but there is a certain freedom of speech, like in the university freedom of speech, where, you know, if you want to have a full discussion, you need to hear all voices.
Yeah, agreed. And I think maybe to be crystal clear on that, we're not saying that these platforms don't have the right to censor and restrict. But if they are going to do that, then they need to kind of get off their high horse of being an impartial platform. They can't have it both ways.
Right. Okay, so to go on to question number two. Is it possible to make fact-checking fair? What's the goal? Is the goal just to make sure that people aren't misinformed? So I sort of thought about this a little bit. Like, you can say that there are fair people in other areas of life, like an umpire or a referee in sports. I don't know about you, but I don't have a problem saying, hey, it's possible to have a fair referee. And even when you get something even more complicated, like a judge, in court, yes, you could have a biased judge. I'm sure there are a lot of biased judges in history. I'm sure there are judges on the take, but I don't necessarily, I don't think, oh, like the judicial system is screwed because it's impossible to be a completely unfair judge. No, I think that there are principles. I didn't go to law school. I didn't go to judge school. There isn't judge school. But I think that there are principles that they follow, which requires a lot of learning, by the way. It's not just, you know, based on emotion and all that. Like, if you want to be a judge, you have to learn a lot and you have to read a lot of historical examples and think through them. But I think that... And a judge will be the first to tell you, even a very left-wing judge will tell you, like, no, court cases are not decided by, like, what the majority of the population want. Like, you actually have to be careful about what evidence is shown, what's allowed, what's not. The process is very important in order for it to be fair. And so I don't think that the idea of a judge is in some way impossible. And yet, when I think about information on these social networks, it seems impossible to me. Do you see why I'm... how do you feel about that, Aaron? I feel like those are two different things.
Yeah, I think the sports analogy is instructive. Because we've seen, you mentioned umpires, and I guess I think in baseball there's usually a team of umpires out on the diamond,
sure.
or in football they have several referees out there. In both those sports, we've seen in recent years the introduction of what's the terminology? Is it
review?
Yeah, video review. So previously it used to be that, you know, whatever the referee or the umpire on the ground, his call was final, because once the play has happened, you can't second guess the guy who was there and saw it. Now that we have video from multiple angles, it is possible that if there's a disagreement between the team of referees, or if one of the referees is not entirely confident in what he's observed, that he can, you know, call on the team in the back room to review the tape, or one of the teams in some cases can demand a review if they don't agree with the call. And I think that makes sense, because we have video evidence, we have, you know, measurable data there, and so we can get closer to the truth rather than relying on witness statements functionally, which can be unreliable.
Right. So
that's much more difficult, though, when we get into a case where we're not purely talking about facts, where opinions are a piece of it, and perception and perspective really put a filter on what we're viewing here. And so I think anything political quickly runs the risk of falling into that area.
Yeah, yeah. Also, like, you would have to be an expert in a lot of different areas. You'd have to be a medical expert. You'd have to be an epidemiologist. You'd have to be an expert on our voting system. I don't think that Facebook can employ or route to all the experts that are there.
Yeah, well, I think when, like, an organization like Snopes, the theory was that they had a huge panel of experts available to them so that they could get the right person to address a particular question.
Right.
But it really comes down to framing, I think.
Snopes has run into so many problems as well.
Yeah. To have an effective fact checking, you need to very narrowly frame the statement and the facts against which you are checking, which is virtually impossible to do with a lot of statements in the political field.
Right. So I actually started this podcast, the Local Maximum, started talking about this way back in episode 9. I did a solo show on fixing Facebook. And the solution that I recommended was to actually offload the role of fact checkers to various other companies and let the consumer decide which one they're going to subscribe to. And so to have a little bit of competition there. The problem with that that's going to be now is, you know, the activists are going to say that's not good enough, because people are going to go to the wrong fact checker and they're just going to give a completely different, completely skewed view of the world. But I think at least if we had that, then we'd know what their stances were, and we'd see, you know, we'd have it as a whole. It wouldn't just be one Trump tweet. It would be this fact check organization. What is it about their whole world that you could kind of study it a little bit more? But all that nuance is not going to be allowed.
Yeah, well, and I think
it would be interesting, though.
This is maybe getting ahead to your third question a little bit, but I think that goes counter to one of the main objectives of fact checking here, and that's to make sure that the right facts are being seen by everybody, not just the people who perhaps agree with the fact checking approach of a certain organization.
I
agree with the approach that Snopes or insert another company here takes, and so I use them as a fact checking resource. You want it to be Snopes is right. They know how to do this, and I want them to fact check everything, and nobody should be able to read any information on the internet that hasn't been run through that filter.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I think it would be interesting. Like if I could set my fact checker, I could set it to Snopes. I could set it to the New York Times fact checker.
It's like being able to choose your search engine.
I could set it to
if I don't want everything to be recorded by Google, I can DuckDuckGo it.
Yeah. I could set it to far right conservative fact checker, whatever I want. And then you could actually see what the differences are. But yeah, again, that's not what they're trying to do here.
They're not looking for a market solution.
Right.
That's for sure.
Yeah. So, okay. Who and what to fact check to begin with? That's obviously a question. There is way too many tweets, just tweets alone, not even counting what's on Facebook and whatnot, to start fact checking. So they have to decide what to look at. Maybe they can look at stuff from like the big players, like Trump and other things. But as you point out, this is an editorial decision in and of itself.
Yeah, well, it's in terms of the statement itself, but also the notability of the person making it and the field in which they're making. So, like you said before, that when Trump makes a statement about mail-in ballots, that rises perhaps to the level of being fact-checked, but not when Lady Gaga or another Twitter celebrity who is not considered to have expertise in that field. Not that I think many people would say that Trump has expertise in elections, but because of his position, his opinion there is given more weight.
Right. So, all right. And a lot of this is a matter of interpreting data, and I'll give the examples of hydroxychloroquine begin with, but even the election one is, it's not just this is the data, it's this is the right way to interpret the data. And that makes me nervous. As we know from Bayesian inference, there's a lot of wiggle room there, a lot of you could set your priors differently there. They give the impression that there is an objective right way to interpret data when there really isn't. So, right. So hydroxychloroquine is an interesting one. It's a political hot button issue. The data goes back and forth. It's great for coronavirus. It's not so good for coronavirus. As I mentioned before, the French study that I looked at a couple months ago, it looked like it was helpful in treating COVID, but unclear how much, like more had to be done, a small sample size. But then there was this fake study that was published, or it wasn't a, it was a, they faked the numbers and it said, hydroxychloroquine is terrible. The news trumpeted that out because now it's a partisan issue. And then the New York Times had to issue a retraction, or I don't think it was a New York Times retraction, but they reported on the retraction of those studies. So who knows, it could go back and forth more. It's sort of like, I could see a fake study coming out and then the fact checker taking the fake study and using it to fact check other people like that. And if you think that won't happen, that's naive.
Yeah, bad data tends to persist, especially out in the internet.
Especially fits in your worldview.
Even if it's been fact checked, it's very difficult to kill it off completely.
Yeah, and nowadays, both sides of the equation. Like the way the media, the way the media cycle goes, all that matters is what's said in the 24-hour period that we're talking about this issue. And then it moves on. So that snap judgment is really matters. Like these fact checkers aren't going to have the time to really look into these things.
Yeah, and we've seen that. I think we've talked before about reporting on diet and any number of studies. I think this we may have touched on in our discussion of p-values, that the media is particularly bad at taking scientific studies and communicating the correct interpretation of the data and the results. That you're better off betting that they've gotten the interpretation 180 degrees off of truth than to assume that they're accurate in their reporting on it. So that, right. That plays into the scenario here, even when fact checking is in play.
Okay, I'm gonna jump to another sponsor right now. If that's all right, because I want to tell you about Rion, R-I-O-N. I am really happy that they sponsored the show because it's not a huge company. It's like a small innovative project that someone wants to get out there, and they want to find some people to collaborate with or to learn from. So I think that's great. So anyway, we're talking about data formats here. You might think data formats. What do I care about data formats? But guess what? You use data formats, Aaron. You use data formats, whether you know it or not. I use JSON a lot. So if you're a software engineer or a data scientist, how you store and transfer your data can make your life easier or harder. It can make your life faster or slower. It can make things more expensive or less expensive. So you want to learn about data formats, standard ones, all the standard ones, but they're trying to, this is something that people are trying to do that's really innovative. And so if you want to make some improvements, I encourage you to check out Rion, R-I-O-N, Raw Internet Object Notation. If you need to export, import, store, or exchange large amounts of data on a regular basis, then you can benefit from a compact, fast, and versatile data format. Rion is a binary format, which is both compact and fast to read and write. A data structure serialized to Rion requires 20 to 50% fewer bytes than the same data structured with JSON. The fewer bytes also translates to 20 to 50% faster read and write speeds. You could learn more about Rion at localmaxradio.com/124. I'll link it there. All right, so let's wrap up this issue about, well, no, we still have to get to number three, right? Are the fact checkers even going to try to be a dispassionate arbiter of information? I think we said that's not even going to be their purpose. Perhaps this is just going to be a team of activists, because it seems like the only thing that people want to fact check are the types of things that activists, political activists, would be interested in. So
yeah, I'm not willing to discount that unbiased fact checkers in the pursuit of truth might be out there, but I think it's going to be a nature of the system that those most attracted and most passionate about playing in the area are going to be those with an activist axe to grind. That's who's going to be attracted to this process.
So I linked to this article, the National Post. Do you know what that is? Is that like a...
I'm not familiar with them, no.
National... All right. Well, I'll have to look at it. But I'll link to this. Obviously, someone's saying it. Facebook's fact checker... lead stories is staffed exclusively by Democrat Party donors, CNN staffers, and defeat Trump activists. So let's actually see what the National Post is. I'm sure it's not like the New York Times is saying this, but it's hard to, I don't know. But anyway, it feels true. I know I shouldn't say it feels true, but it feels true. And it based on my experience in the industry. So one final thought that I want to leave you with: what is the role of the engineer at these companies in this? So a lot of engineers listen to this show. I'm an engineer. There's only so much you could push back, but you can actually push back even without quitting your job if you don't outright refuse to work on a project, which usually isn't even quitting. Engineering managers and product managers actually do feel the heat when there isn't buy-in. So definitely express that. Prepare to walk away from projects when they get out of control. Find alternatives. Personally, I'm working to try to get to a point where I could be more independent. I should have done it years ago, but actually, Foursquare has been a pretty great place to work, so I haven't had to. But now I'm sort of thinking, okay, yes, Foursquare is still a great place to work, but I want to, you know, see if I could consult, see if I can, you know, get income elsewhere to be able to, you know, to be able to say, okay, let me try to make sure that everything I'm working on now and especially in the future is aligns with my value. Also, you could be on the committees to determine the design and implementation of these projects and systems. You might be surprised, but at least nominally, these companies have to often feel like they have to have an open discussion when they implement policies about fact checking. And, you know, if you're an engineer, you could actually write some of those policies, and engineers are usually in a very good position to make sure that to make sure there are like fallbacks in there to see that a system is fair. Usually, you know, engineers working alongside, and you could do it without like, you know, being a dick about it sometimes. So, yes, but is there a way to really push back against the fanatics if there are real fanatics at your company? I don't know. That remains to be seen. All right. So
yeah, I think a big piece of that makes the tech world much more susceptible to this is the rate at which companies pivot. I have a long history of working in the defense industry, which has certain ethical quandaries associated with it. However, pretty much all of those companies, when I applied to them, I knew they were working in the defense industry. I had a fairly good idea of the types of programs they worked on. It was not a surprise to me.
Right.
I don't know if that can be said for everybody who hired on at Google or Facebook or Amazon, yeah. Because 10, you know, maybe there aren't that many employees who've been there for a decade. But if you joined 10 years ago, they may not have been doing face recognition, and they may not have had military contracts, and so there's a lot of things that have changed, and so the employee backlash is perhaps more reasonable to be expected there.
The backlash going the opposite direction for now.
Yeah, you can't as easily say, well, you knew what you were getting into. Why did you bother to come work for a company like this? Maybe that's changing now that there's a lot more public discussion about these types of concerns. But I guess the fact that these companies are also ginormous conglomerates and have their fingers in so many different sectors plays into that as well.
Yeah. Now, even a place like Foursquare, we're working on different things all the time. I remember when I was working in Attribution, like they wanted to do a project with Facebook, and me and the engineering team really didn't want to do it. And so, yeah, we pushed back. And no, I'm not saying Foursquare and Facebook, it's public knowledge. Yeah, they partner with Facebook on some things, but we didn't want to do this particular project. So we ended up not doing it. We ended up prioritizing other things because the teams are given a lot of autonomy.
And an important piece of that, but then it ends up that you had an alternative. It wasn't simply that you came in and said, no, we refuse to do this work. It was that you kind of redirected it towards, we see a better use of these resources as being, you know, such and such a type of program.
Yeah.
And that's a valuable lesson to be made there, that you come with solutions, not with problems.
Yeah. But another reason why, you know, we got what we wanted in that case is that then Facebook got into the whole Cambridge Analytica thing. And so Facebook was like, oh, we're deferring all this ad stuff that we're doing.
Dodged a bullet there.
So it was like we kind of, if Facebook wanted to go full steam ahead and was throwing all this money at the company, I don't know what the discussion would have been. But at least on the margin, I think we pushed it in some way. All right. So I want to end with a quote that you found from a blog about fact checking. Take it away. What was this one that you found?
Yeah. So the title was The Perils of Social Media Fact Checking. And I think it was originally a Facebook post, and then it was reposted to this blog. But it's the money quote is really the section that I'll read here. Quote, fact-checking, unfortunately, isn't what we think it is. Despite the superficial appearance, fact-checking isn't a helpful tool for determining the truth and for forming an accurate opinion. Instead, it is actually an in-out group filter which segregates people by belief and value, while allowing each group to believe they hold the factual high ground and to claim any subsequent moral position which proceeds from being factually correct. Facts don't change people's minds. And it goes on in that vein, but it raises some very good points that fact-checking, many people who are endorsing the idea of fact-checking may see it as, well, if we can all agree on the facts, that we're all on the same page, then we will be able to bring people together. And I think we're seeing that is not how this
different
tool
facts,
of
different,
fact-checking is being used.
Yeah, but even the same facts is different interpretation.
The nature of how the facts are checked is causing us to divide further.
I understand that statement, facts don't change people's minds, but sometimes they do. I mean, I feel like, yes, I've seen facts that I've dismissed, I'm sure, that, you know, because it didn't fit into what I'm doing. We all do that, but like, I'm sure we've all had cases where you've seen facts and you say, okay, I need to rethink this thing.
Well, yeah. So, and as advocates of Bayesian thinking, we can't adopt that statement as immutable, an immutable truth. However, facts alone do not change people's minds. That someone needs to be, first, they need to be put in a mental state where they are receptive to having their mind changed, and then you can present them with the facts. And that is almost never what happens, certainly not on social media. Usually social media facts are being used as a weapon, and that causes people to only further entrench their defenses.
Yeah. All right. So let's turn to machine learning now. I know I love discussing machine learning on this program. Just a quick discussion, because there's these generative models going around Twitter, and basically what it does is it's a face depixelizer. So if you have a picture of your face, Aaron, and then, you know, if you pixelize it in order to, you know, let's say You know what it is to pixelate an image, right? I don't have to explain that.
To obscure detail.
Right. So it just looks like boxes. The question was, can I build a machine learning algorithm to generate the original face? So this would have been useful. I remember 10 years ago when I was on online dating, there was something called crazyblinddate.com. Were you ever on that? I used it like twice. I didn't use it all the time.
But I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah, okay. You were set on a blind date with someone, but you only saw their pixelated face. But if I had this, I could actually regenerate their full face and cheat the system. That went out a long time ago. But anyway, they built something here, and oof, this is not what you want to see. So this is a Google research. It's actually a cool project, but someone took a, and by the way, it's very easy to come up with the training data for this, right? Because all you have to do is take tons of real pictures of people, which there are tons on the internet, and then pixelate them, and then you have your example and your answer. The answer is the real image. The example is the pixelated image. And so they fed it a picture of a pixelized Obama, and it turned into a white guy, like a very white guy with maybe the same face shape and maybe like similar ears to Obama, but that's it. And then people put in other ones, and it just turned everyone into white men and women. I don't think it's necessarily, this wasn't like, this is a sort of a research, a test project. So it wasn't like they've got the PC police after them as well, but it's an interesting think piece. Like, okay, let's think about this, because is this going to cause, is this an example of bias, and what is causing it here? And I think that's an interesting question. Did they just train it on a bunch of white guys? Or is it that the training data needs to be balanced? Or is it that, their algorithm is somehow, a lot of times when I design algorithms, I think about, okay, if I have a case that's an edge case, I have some of that edge case in the data. But is it true that if I actually encounter this edge case, it's going to say, okay, make sure this is similar to these edge cases in the data? Did they like fail to do that? Is there some piece of their statistical model off? It could be any of these things, or it could just simply be that their training data is biased. But it's really fascinating to check out. So I'm just going to post that and basically make of that what you will. I think it's sort of interesting. Another thing is, like, what's the real applications of this? Is this just a parlor trick? I mean, if it works out very well, I could see like security cameras. It's almost scary, right? Even if you have a very cheap camera, if this actually works well, you could
This is the future that's been promised to us by CSI, being able to get a grainy pixelated image and say, enhance, and have it come out crystal clear and solve the mystery.
Yeah. Now, the problem is statistically enhanced. So first of all, if I have a picture of a bookshelf, but I can't see the individual things of the bookshelf, the enhance will not add those things in, because there's no indication that those things are in the pixels. It'll probably add a clean bookshelf. So enhance almost works so far. And you have to be careful, because it's going to be very... it's such a blend of reality.
Or do you have an algorithm that's going to interpolate and say, well, in all the pictures of bookshelves I've seen that were, had books of this color, that book actually turned out to be the following volume.
Right. So it's sort of a blend of reality and just posting in things from other pictures that it's seen, that it could be extremely deceptive. Now, there are some good things that could come out of it. Look, like, you could take old videos and old photos and sort of enhance them to HD. Like we all have old black and white photos, and they're algorithms that will colorize it. And imagine seeing, photos of your great grandparents. I once saw a photo. I actually today my parents were showing me a photo. My mom was showing me a photo of my great uncle on a basketball team. Someone reposted that on Facebook in like early 1900s. Like, it was black and white It's like, oh, that's a crazy photo. It's kind of like those old photos that this wasn't Yale, but you see old photos on the wall at Yale of, those black and white teams from the 1800s. Like, you could enhance those and make them HD and, see the, like texture of the people's skins and all that. I don't know why I'd want to do that, but yeah, you could bring the past to life like that, and I actually think there's something to that, or making video in HD.
I don't know if we've talked about it before, but some of the earliest video footage captured from the late 1800s, they've gone back and basically done remastering of it in like 4K, and it looks amazing. And it's all because they have very sophisticated interpolation algorithms.
Right. So this is, I think it was called They Will Not Grow Old. That was the World War One documentary by Peter Jackson. And some of the footage there is up, and I don't know how they did it. I don't know if they used machine learning or something else, but it's really clear, crystal clear footage from 1914, 1915, and you almost feel like you're there. And I feel like with these algorithms, you can, we'll just get better and better at that. So that to me is the coolest application. But then there's a lot of cases here that worry me, where it's going to be like in Jurassic Park, the original movie, where they made the dinosaurs, but they put some frog DNA in there and screwed up the whole park. The whole park screwed. No, but everyone died. It's going to be, this is the reality, but not quite. We added some stuff, not some cut and paste from other photos, but the machine took ideas from other photos and posted them in there, which is something that, it's a blend of reality and fantasy that we're all going to have to get used to.
Yeah, who knows where it will lead? And as with everything else, be wary of garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah. All right. So, I saw you posted the train arrival. That was one of the old, that's from the 1800s. All right. I'll post that on the show notes page, localmaxradio.com/124. Anything else before I talk about what we're going to next week?
No, I mean, I think this fact-checking topic is going to be ripe for revisiting as we...
This is a lot more today than we thought.
As a country, figure out how we're going to tackle it. I don't think it's going to get simpler, certainly between now and the election, and I don't think it's going to go away after that. So keep watching for developments. I'm sure there'll be more to talk about in the future.
All right. So given that we are having election, I'm going to start a two-part series next week on the Electoral College, which is how we elect the president here in the United States. I know with all the emotions flying high, it's kind of strange to just have a calm and collected discussion about the Electoral College, but it's important. I know I have a lot of international listeners. I'm going to work to make it interesting for you as well, but there are two parts to this. The first, we're going to hear about the Electoral College system from a defender of that system, someone who's been writing about it for a long time, and I have an interview there. Then in the second part, I interviewed someone who was an actual elector. That's the small number of people who end up actually choosing the president in the end. And so this person was an elector, and I talked to him about his experience. We're going to talk about that. And then I'm going to do kind of a more mathematical social choice analysis of what's going on with our presidential election. What are the pros and cons of this type of system? So I'm looking forward to that. If you have anything to add, definitely email localmaxradio@gmail.com because I haven't finished these yet. And I'm looking forward to getting these out.
I'm definitely eager to hear from the actual elector. That'll be kind of a neat experience.
And
we haven't heard that much discussion of it in the last few months, but there's been a lot of talk about banning the Electoral College in favor of the popular vote.
Oh, we're covering that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a topic that I think we're going to get a lot of passionate input on.
All right. Thanks for joining me today, Aaron.
My pleasure.
Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com if you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show. Send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, at Max Sklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.